This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation, as always, on WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. You can call us at 860-275-7266. Colin McEnroe is off this week. He's actually facing a suspension. We learned that he attended a Maroon 5 concert in 2013. And so he's on indefinite leave from the program. Actually, there's a reason he's not here. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. Sitting in his seat today is Max Reese, political reporter for NBC Connecticut. Hello there, Max.
Hey, good morning, John.
Mark Pazniokas is Capitol Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. Hello there, Paz.
I'm playing myself today.
You're playing yourself today. Also playing herself today is Daniela Altomare, State House reporter at the Hartford Current. Hello there, Daniela.
Hi.
Well, we're going to start, well, on the last day of the legislative session. We said at the top of the program, just a few hours left in the legislative session. Actually, it's almost an entire day's worth of hours because we're going to go into the late hours of the night. And then at midnight tonight, the legislative session ends. We're going to go through a bit of where we are with the budget, but maybe we can just start with some of the things that have actually happened. And I don't know, Paz, I'll start with you. The push to get a casino in Bridgeport, that's done already, right?
Well, it's done and it's not going to happen. That was one of the issues that you had to struggle with, the idea of, is this just theater for the session? Because there was a sense from day one that this was not going to get across the finish line, certainly not in the Senate. So I think the bigger question about this is the extent to which it's teeing up a major debate for the new General Assembly and the next governor about whether or not Connecticut wants to expand casino gambling, because there is an expectation that once the MGM Springfield Casino opens in a few months, that revenues from the two tribal casinos in Connecticut are going to plummet. And once that happens, I think the atmosphere changes about whether or not to open Connecticut to a casino, perhaps in Bridgeport, which would abrogate the revenue sharing that we now have with the tribes. But once their revenues continue to fall, the question is, could the state of Connecticut get a better deal by opening Bridgeport to MGM or somebody else for a commercial casino?
Well, what has the status, Daniela, of this debate around casino gambling been at the state legislature this year? Because obviously we've been talking for quite some time since Massachusetts decided that they were going to put in additional casinos, including one in Springfield, about whether or not Connecticut needed to get into this business. There's the question about revenues. There's the question about, you know, whether or not a long-term deal with the tribes makes sense. Of course, these tribes also have their eyes on what's happening in Massachusetts themselves. I mean, what are people talking about at the Capitol as far as the future of gambling in the state?
Well, I think Paz laid it out pretty clearly. I mean, you know, once this happens, right now it's all kind of theoretical, but once it happens and we start to see the impact, that could change the debate radically. There's also, you know, a feeling among people in Bridgeport that, you know, Hartford got its, where's ours? And there's a real sort of push from folks in that part of the state to say, you know, wait a minute, you know, where's our quote unquote bailout? Where's our benefit? Where's our boondoggle?
Well, but I want to ask about that. I mean, Max is the, and we're going to talk about the status of this big Hartford bailout, all of the money that the state owes, or that the city owes, being essentially bailed out by the state. Are these apples to apples here? Is a bailout for Bridgeport? Does that look like building a casino there? Is a bailout for New Haven something else?
I think it's about attention. I think that New Haven and Bridgeport are saying, we've been neglected up here for the last couple of years. All you've talked about is Hartford. I think a piece that has to do with, you know, Luke Bronin's up there all the time talking about issues facing Hartford. Nobody has the ear of the Governor Dan Malloy quite like Luke Bronin. But then you have Bridgeport, the state's largest city. You have New Haven, when one could argue the state's most successful city in a number of respects. And they're saying, well, you put all this focus on Hartford, what about us? Which is why Tony Harp and Joe Ganim kind of united looking for a Bridgeport casino. And on that, the way I kind of heard the conversation a little bit shift toward the very end of it was, it's a choice. Do you want commercial gambling with a company like MGM or another operator, or do you want tribal gaming? Because one of these is going to disappear is kind of what they're saying, hint, hint, mm-hmm. Right? So don't you want a new future for revenue with a commercial gaming center? And they even floated 35% for slots, 25% for table games. What sounds like a lot of money, but of course it's dead now, and who knows if it's going to come back.
But I don't know. If Colin were here, Paz, he would say, you know, hitching up to the star that is casino gambling, given the fact that the take at these casinos has been dropping substantially. There's more competition coming from other places, not just Springfield. People are using their money elsewhere. I mean, yeah, there were revenues back when this started a couple of years ago that really opened people's eyes, but those revenues have been shrinking for quite some time.
If Colin was here, he would have been pithier and funnier. Let's just get that out of the way.
Is that really harsh.
It is harsh.
Is that an insult?
To me? He's been spending too much time at the state capitol, I think,
over the course of the last 30 years.
But anyway, please continue.
I haven't been to a Maroon 5 concert.
To continue. No, there's no question that this is a long-term trend. The tribal deal cut by Lowell Weicker a quarter century ago has been pretty much a great deal for Connecticut. The two casinos have developed in a part of the state that they've had, as far as gambling goes, have had the lightest impact on the state, certainly, that you avoided some of the troubles had it been an urban center. And it's produced $7 billion over a quarter century. But yes, from a high of 2007, when they produced $420 million for the state, it's fallen, and it's fallen, below $300 million. It's projected to fall below $200 million once there's more competition in Springfield, and of course, there's also a casino that is under construction, although I guess temporarily suspended, just outside Boston. There's a lot to that issue. The market at some point is going to be saturated. Well, you're just sort of moving dollars around. One of the issues with MGM in Bridgeport, or anyone in Bridgeport, is what will New York City ultimately do? There's a moratorium there. It's going to expire. That would affect the value of any casino in Bridgeport. Right now, Bridgeport, the value to the casino industry is it's more or less on the doorstep to the New York City market. So all these things have kind of swirled in a boiling pot. But the other thing that's clear is MGM, whether it's mainly to play defense in Springfield to make sure that the state of Connecticut did not do anything to make the East Windsor Casino viable, they've been spending a lot of money, a lot of time, which raises the question, do they really, really want Bridgeport, and what are they going to do next year? Because they've been lobbying right to the deadline.
You brought this up earlier, Daniela, in the context of this bailout to the city of Hartford that, of course, Luke Bronin, the mayor of Hartford, former gubernatorial candidate Luke Bronin, has been lobbying for. So there's a measure in the legislature to limit the extent of this bailout, right? To essentially cap how long the Hartford bailout goes. But it's kind of interesting who supports and who opposes this bailout. Can we talk this through a little bit? I'm a little unclear as to who's on what side of the Hartford bailout bill.
Yeah, I'm pretty unclear on that too. But Pat's going to answer that question. I just want to say one more thing on casinos, because one of the things that the proponents are arguing, yes, it's correct, the amount of money, the bags of money that were being able to be made earlier or in the 90s, just isn't there anymore. But these are economic development projects that have a lot of other attributes, hotels and shopping and all kinds of other things. And obviously the jobs they bring just in construction, as well are big pluses, I think, for people who support that type of development.
Paz, you were raising your hand quite enthusiastically.
The one thing I'm clear on is the thing that shifted with the Hartford bailout bill is, as my colleagues here have noted, early on, Bridgeport and New Haven, the delegation said, "What about us? Connecticut." Things are very parochial at the General Assembly, and quite often they break down in terms of what's my area getting versus the other areas. So there was that factor, and there was a lot of complaining about the deal for Hartford. And then the Republicans step forward and say, perhaps we will blow up the whole Municipal Accountability Review Board process. And then it shifted. And then it shifted to the New Haven and Bridgeport legislators saying, wait a minute, we may need that lifeboat at some point. We don't right now, but let's not destroy something. So this whole debate, I think, is really not put the entire Connecticut General Assembly in a good light. It shows, again, how parochial it can be. We are a small state, but it's been striking at the inability of the legislature as a body to say, okay, what is a rational public policy on how to maintain the economic health of the cities, which are becoming, in the eyes of the business world, really the centers of commerce again?
It's put them not in a good light, Paz, because usually they're bathed in such bright sunlight in the way that the lawmakers do their business.
There is that.
I think that there's a little bit – not a little bit. I think there's a ton of overall doublespeak coming from almost everybody involved with the Hartford debate except for Luke Bronin, where Lucas said, look, we need the help. If you don't give us the help, we're going to file for bankruptcy. And then – you know, then what we essentially heard when the deal was brokered by Governor Dan Malloy and OPM and Denise Napier, that essentially you had the city of Hartford and the mayor saying, well, if it's not our fault that they didn't understand what they were voting for when they did this, which, you know, may or may not be true. But I think that based on everyone who was there at the very end of the budget negotiation and the budget process at the end of last year, I'm not sure anybody quite viewed it as a total bailout of Hartford. And then we realize in February and March, that's actually they're arguing it's exactly what it was. But you have the Republicans saying, well, this should not be our problem. This really should be Hartford's problem. But last year they were saying, no, this is our problem and we want to help them out for 2 years. But now it's not our problem anymore. And now New Haven and Bridgeport, to Paz and Danielle's point, well, they're saying, well, we might need this. So this is our problem, but you weren't dealing with our problems earlier. So it's really clear. As you can tell,
it's clearly.
Can we diagram that?
Let's diagram that sentence. I want to go quickly before we move too far from the issue of casinos to Peter, who's calling from Stanford. Hey, Peter, what's up?
Yes, I just wanted to point out New York does have a couple casinos, one in Yonkers and one in I think it's the other
Belmont Aqueduct.
I don't know if they're full fledged casinos, but they're video gaming type of. They have some type of slot machines and stuff, and they're getting more. I think all this – I think casinos are the wrong way to go because we don't really have – our income base is going down, and the state is trying more and more to squeeze out money from the middle class of money that we don't have. And, so it's just another form of tax on everything.
Hey, Peter, thank you so much for that.
Well, I think part of that's a great point because some of the people opposed, especially in the Senate, to Paz's point earlier, you have people opposed to gambling for completely different reasons than just allying with the Mashantucket Pequots and the Mohegan tribes. They're saying, we're not sure this is any kind of a good idea at all to expand gambling. And I think to Peter's point, that's, I think, exactly what part of the dynamic is in the Senate.
And there are limited casinos at Yonkers and at Aqueduct, and they've been doing well. And the question is, when I mentioned the moratorium, the question is, when the moratorium expires, would Manhattan consider a casino, or would New York allow these two limited casinos to become, full-fledged gambling resorts as opposed to, the hybrid they are now?
So before we take a break, let's turn a little bit to what's happening with the state budget. Unlike last year, lawmakers hope to adjourn tonight with a budget deal in place, trying to figure out what the likelihood of that is happening. House Speaker Joe Arasimowitz didn't sound overly optimistic early on Tuesday. Here's some of what he had to say.
We should come in now and do the biennium budget fixes, but some want to renegotiate the entire budget, including all the things they didn't get last year. That's borderline bargaining in bad faith.
Daniela, we talked about this a little bit last week. I mean, where are we with budget negotiations such as they are right now?
Well, I just hope that we don't see a repeat of last year. I mean, it was Halloween. The budget was signed on Halloween. So, hopefully that lesson is imprinted in lawmakers' minds. It was a mess. And you had angry cities and towns. You had, frustrated, social service providers. I mean, it was just a disaster. So I don't know. Did they learn their lesson? Who knows?
What's the holdup this year, Paz?
Oddly enough, it's not money.
It's not money. So I thought that the whole thing about the budget was about money and where the money's coming from.
You'd think, wouldn't you?
Yeah, yeah. But so what's about this
year? separating the Democratic and Republican budgets are about $19 million in spending.
So it's a $20 billion budget. You're saying $19 million with an M.
Yes. So that's rounding error. That is less than 0.1%. So what really is going on here is an argument about things that are related to the budget, but mainly collective bargaining rights. The Republicans want to reopen the whole debate about how Connecticut negotiates with its employees over retirement health. Now, there's a contract in place until 2027. So that's the other question as to why on the eve of the session ending, or actually not the eve, on the day of the session ending, why are they struggling with changing something that really can't do much until 2027?
That's a fair question.
It might have something to do with, just might have something to do with the fact that there are elections this year.
What?
Yes, I know.
Wow.
I know.
Breaking news.
It is.
I didn't know that.
So I'm guessing that that has a little bit to do with this. This is framing the election. So the question is, today, will they say, okay, let's just make some limited budget revisions, because there are some real things at stake. If they don't do this, Governor Malloy, on his way out the door, will be the one to say, okay, this is how the budget will be adjusted to make sure it stays in balance. And that's going to mean cities and towns are not going to get some aid that they hope to get. It would also mean that there would be certain other things that wouldn't done, such as restoring budget cuts for a Medicare savings program that's very important to the elderly, that there's some things, the recipients of Husky Aid, which is health care insurance for the poor. So it is this kind of interesting showdown over, again, $19 million.
I don't think, and it's kind of crazy, especially yesterday, I don't think that it actually sunk in how awful the legislative branch looked as an institution for all of last summer and half of the fall. I don't think they quite, it's almost like they forgot how silly they looked last year. When I know I'm speaking for myself. I'm sure it happened to several of you. When you go to the grocery store and people go, what's going on? Why don't we have a budget? And here we are on the last day and we still don't have a budget. And it doesn't quite have the same tenor as last year. But look, if you're not somebody who covers the building every day, it all looks the same. These guys don't know what they're doing up there. And the Republicans are demanding, and they're better, I will say, they're much better at framing the debate normally, saying, if you do this at home, this would be ridiculous. They're much better at that than the Democrats. But the Democrats are the ones saying, let's make those adjustments. Let's make the adjustments. We have a bipartisan budget and get out of here. Then the Republicans are saying, well, let's vote on our budget because our budget's the only one. And we can get into the pension problems with it. We can get into spending money out of the rainy day fund with it. We could talk about all that stuff. The things that you'd have trouble explaining to a credit card company when you want to go past your debt limit and say, no, we're going to get savings in 5 years. It's cool. You can't explain that at home. And I think that I don't think that they quite understand how silly they look as an institution. And in an election year, they both think that they're playing the right cards. And, you know, obviously we're not going to know that until November.
It's always a question I have, Daniela, is notwithstanding the fact that people might come up to Max in the supermarket and ask him, what's happening with the state budget? I don't have many people ask me that. And I don't know how many people really worry so much about that. Once again, we're worried in the summertime about an election and how people are framing their reelection chances around something that I frankly don't know if Connecticut residents are all that in tune with. Am I wrong about that from a political standpoint?
I don't think they're in tune with a lot of it. You're right. You're absolutely correct. However, there is a general census. What are these, you know, guys doing up there? I mean, you know, even to the point, you know.
The word is bozo. You can say it on the radio. It's not one of the seven words that George Carlin talked about.
I wasn't going to say a word that Sam Belsito said on the hot mic the other day.
Yeah, okay, let's not say that.
We won't say that. But, you know, even to the point, you know, Christine Stewart, a good, you know, great reporter and frequent guest on your show, you know, her husband, Doug, had made a point on Twitter yesterday. It's like, these guys are going off and off about, you know, all their wonderful colleagues, and they're spending hours of, you know, time praising one another, the departing members. It's a nice ritual. But, you know, then they say, oh, guess what? We ran out of time. You know, we couldn't do the work. We couldn't get these bills passed. We couldn't get these important pieces of legislation passed. And I think the average member of the public, they don't care about the ins and outs. They don't know who's running or who's this or, you know, but they're just like, what are these guys doing over there?
And that is a very real thing. I mean, in some ways, it may seem like a minor point, Paz, but the fact that near the end of the legislative session, we do spend hours of active legislative time just doing honorariums for people who are not going to be serving anymore, when at the end of tonight they'll say, well, we didn't have time to do X, fill in the blank. It does, I would think, leave a bad taste in some voters' mouths.
It does. To Danielle's point, I don't know the extent to which the broader public really tunes in on that. And another thing about the time they spend in the Senate patting themselves on the back and saying goodbye to the half dozen senators who are not seeking reelection. The Senate can move a lot of stuff quickly. Mm-hmm. The things that are going to die, they may say we didn't have time, but if they wanted to bring them up, you know, and I'm thinking of things like the minimum wage increase. You know, there were other issues as to why that didn't happen. It's not just a question of, oh, they spent too much time saying goodbye to Ted Kennedy Jr.
You mentioned the minimum wage increase. I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk about that issue and maybe a couple others at the legislature. We're also going to get into an interesting kind of slow motion race for the 5th Congressional District, something that we thought might be heating up a little bit at this point with Elizabeth Estes stepping aside, but not so much a hot race right now. We're talking with Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror, ctmirror.org, Danielle Altomare, State House reporter at the Hartford Current, current.com, and Max Reese, political reporter for NBC Connecticut. I don't even know, what's the website, Max?
NBCConnecticut.com.
See, I didn't even know that. Max Reese is here as well. Colin McEnroe is off this week. I'm John Dankosky. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Colin McEnroe is away this week. We're joined by Max Reese, political reporter for NBC Connecticut, Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror, and Daniella Altomare, State House reporter for the Hartford Current. Let's go through a couple other things that they're tackling at the state capitol. There's been a move towards states raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour around the country. In Connecticut, both the governor and Democratic legislative leaders would like to do that. But whether it actually gets through the Senate, maybe up to maybe one legislator. You mentioned it before, Paz. Where are we right now with a $15 an hour minimum wage?
Well, instead of fighting 15, they're going to try for 12. That's my motto that I've given them, and that seems to be where they're looking at. Today, it seems to be too late. The House Majority Leader last night told me not necessarily. They could still try today. They have been struggling for weeks to figure out where the votes are. There's a House bill, but then they decided they would try in the Senate, which the Senate, of course, is evenly split, 18-18. The assumption is there would be no Republican votes, so that makes every Democrat a king or a queen. And one of the Democrats, Joan Hartley, who was the only Democrat who did not vote to raise the minimum wage in 2014, she has been very elusive as far as whether or not she would commit to voting to raise the minimum wage, whether it be $15 over several years or go for something more modest. The question of $15, one of the debates is how fast do you get there? They originally had a very aggressive timetable, which even some of the big backers said was probably too aggressive. So now the question is, can you crank it down to $12 an hour, up from $10.10 over a couple of years, and will that fly without a long debate? Because right now, anybody can kill anything simply by threatening to keep talking.
It was not, I don't know, so many years ago, Daniela, that Governor Malloy sat right here in this room with me and said that, you know, moving to a $12 an hour minimum wage is just ludicrous. There's no way we can do that. The state can't afford it. Small business people can't afford it. And now we're in a position where we have Democratic leaders, including him, saying $15 is okay. And I assume a lot of people in the business lobby and some other lawmakers pushing back.
I think it just shows how the Democratic Party has shifted, you know, that this has become now a point that's, you know, sort of been taken for granted. I mean, even Hillary Clinton, you know, back in, you know, before 2016 wasn't really on board with the $15. And then, you know, it's just a measure of, you know, perhaps the Bernie Sanders wing of the party really taking hold these progressive policies sort of becoming the mainstream of the Democratic Party to some degree.
Does that sound right, Max?
I do, because there's now a progressive caucus again at the General Assembly, and they scream and shout for $15 an hour. But also, there's no political courage like the courage you get after you've seen other states do something, where you say, well, they did it, we should do it too. And I think that's where a lot of the pressure comes in. But also, you know, it gives you an idea of how rather dysfunctional the Democrats are as they're in charge, because $15 minimum wage was one of their top priorities at the beginning of the session. They had a big press conference about it, said, hey, this we want to do it. Also, early voting was one of the big things they wanted to do. They said, this is huge, too. They haven't yet brought that up, at least in the Senate. It's now talked about as a serious issue. But, you know, the business lobby in a lot of ways kind of sat to the side when it came to the pay equity question this year about whether you can ask someone how much you were paid at the previous job. They're not going to be that way, and they haven't been that way about the minimum wage. They view that as a very different issue.
Speaking of the courage that one gets when other states jump into it already, another bill that actually passed by relatively large margin was one that commits Connecticut to join the National Popular Vote Compact. It passed 21-14 in the state Senate. Here's Senate President Pro Tem Martin Looney speaking in support of the bill.
The broad popular support in terms of polling data that is reflected in opinion surveys on the national popular vote does accord with that sense of fairness that every vote should count the same wherever it is cast in whatever part of the country.
There was a different take from Senator Michael McLaughlin here.
This is going to be such a legal train wreck that you can't imagine how incredible that's going to be. Just a legal train wreck.
Just the biggest train wreck. So what's the train wreck he's going to talk about? National popular vote essentially passes a way for states to get around that tricky thing in the Constitution that says we've got an electoral college that elects the president.
Well, that same Constitution makes it quite clear it's up to the states how to conduct the elections in their states, even about electing a president of the United States. So Senator McLaughlin may be a bit overwrought in predicting a legal train wreck. A legal challenge, yeah, that probably would be the case. But there seems to be certainly a constitutional basis for this. The thing that was surprising the other day is three Republicans in the Senate joined all 18 Democrats to vote for this. This is an issue that once upon a time was not considered particularly partisan. But because of the fact that two of the past three presidents, and that both of them happen to be Republicans, were elected while losing the popular vote. It would have been a very different debate had John Kerry in 2004 managed to get a few more votes in Ohio, because he then could have won the presidency while losing the popular vote. So we would have had a Republican to win while losing the popular vote and then a Democrat. And it would have been, you know, probably neutralized. But so far, every state to join the National Popular Vote Compact is a blue state.
And that's the way it's going to be, I assume, until they – if they ever get to this vote total that they need.
I think Oklahoma, though. I think actually Oklahoma is a national popular vote, aren't they? I thought they were.
No.
I thought they were. But it's interesting. I spoke with one Republican yesterday who supports national popular vote. And what he said to me was, if the Republican Party thinks that it can keep getting presidential wins by the skin of its teeth after Obama – raked in two elections with doing better in 2012 than he did in 2008, he said Republicans are kidding themselves, especially in his words, a political and demographic reckoning that's coming in states like Georgia and Texas and Arizona, where there are demographics in those states that strongly favor Democrats, maybe not the next electoral college cycle, but maybe the one after that or the one after that, essentially saying Republicans have an opportunity supporting national popular vote to get those votes in places like New York State. Yeah, half of New York State lives in New York City. The other half has nothing to do with New York City. And much the same with in Texas, where half the state is well beyond those rural areas. But then you have a place like Austin, which is blue, saying that there's a way for Republicans to do very well on national popular vote. And I think that's an interesting argument.
I guess it's an interesting argument. And just one point to that, though, Max, is that when you say that the demographics in states like Georgia are going to long-term favor Democrats, well, they're going to long-term favor traditional Democratic voting blocks of African Americans and Latinos.
Yeah.
And the question that was raised by, you know, the Jeb Bush not so terribly long ago was, mightn't the Republican Party think about reaching out to various constituencies a bit differently and take a look at those demographics and say, we got to find those votes somewhere?
I think you'd be absolutely right, but I don't think the president has done them any favors with the help of that outreach. I think that if anything, it's
fair to say.
I think it's fair. I think it's alienated a lot of those people. But also, you know, you'd be remiss that there's no doubt that Democrats have a sour grapes element to this, right? Like, you know, we've lost from their point of view, we've lost two elections. We got more people voting for us. What gives? But yeah, in theory, sure, Republicans should be doing more outreach to some of those groups, you know, more minorities, Latinos, et cetera. But with President Trump, he's just not doing them any favors.
We're going to talk – actually, Paz and I are going to talk more about this on Next this week, our regional show that's coming up at 2 o'clock on Thursday. I want to quickly get to Stuart and Griswold, who's calling about something Danielle and I were talking about a moment ago, this question about whether people are really engaged in this budget process. What's on your mind, Stuart?
I'm in Eastern Connecticut, and basically the towns here in Eastern Connecticut took a large hit last year in – ECS cuts and cuts to the town budget. In the town that I'm in, which is Griswold, if those same cuts are kept in place, if they do not put back the ECS grant money to where it was supposed to be, and if they do not fund the towns like they have in the past, Griswold, even though both the town budget and the Board of Ed budget are coming in with absolutely no increase, will face a 7% increase in its property taxes. We're all very aware of what's going on. I'm on the Board of Ed. I personally feel for the last year that public education is under attack by Hartford. Certainly the different boards in the towns are very aware of what's going on. We're encouraging our unions to become aware of what's happening and what it's going to do to them.
Hey Stuart, but before we move on, I appreciate what you're saying as someone who is involved in politics, someone who's involved in town politics. But as you meet with just folks out in your community, are you hearing from people who are going to vote this November, I'm really upset about what Hartford is doing to Griswold?
I think we're educating them, quite honestly, and we're making an effort to educate them and also educate our state rep and state senator as to how strongly we feel about it.
Stuart, thank you so much for that, Paz.
No, and Stuart's on the front line. School board members are the ones who hear about it most directly, and Joe Arison, which the House Speaker, made that point the other day that in his town of Berlin, right now, they are, if they don't get funding restored from the state, they're looking at teacher layoffs and other cutbacks, and that stuff will be felt and will be felt quickly.
I want to move to one last thing that was actually passed by a 26-10 vote. The state Senate gave final legislative approval to a bill that would ban bump stock devices like the one used by the gunman in the Las Vegas concert shooting massacre last fall. Danielle, I can only assume that this was less controversial in the state of Connecticut than it would be in some other redder states where gun rights are a bit more fraught.
I don't know. I mean, wasn't this something that even President Trump was supportive of and the NRA could get behind? I mean, I don't know. Is that true?
In the end, they didn't. I mean, the bump stocks have become a proxy for broader gun control. It's a device that until the Las Vegas massacre, really people didn't know what they were, including, you know, the leader of one of the largest gun groups in Connecticut. I asked him, do you know anybody who owns one of these things? He said, no. But that didn't make it a big debate. Whether you know the gun people say, look, this is the slippery slope, and it's banning something without compensating people who would have to turn these in. But again, there doesn't seem to be a lot of warmth for bump stocks.
It's definitely red meat for the sort of progressive base. I mean, they're juiced up about it like it was, you know, a huge deal. When you look on, you know, these indivisible groups and the sort of resistance groups, the women's march groups, you look on their Facebook pages like, yay, Connecticut banned bump stocks. And it's, you know, seen as a very big deal to that fired up base.
And to Danielle's point, if you had this debate 1 year ago, nobody would really have a clue what you were talking about. about with a bump stock.
We're gonna move on after our break to the 5th district race. It's an open seat for Congress, which we'd think a lot of money would be pouring in from all over America, a lot of really interesting candidates coming forward. Well, it's been a little interesting trying to figure out where the 5th district race is going. We're talking today with Max Reese from NBC Connecticut, Daniela Altomare from the Hartford Current, Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse. We'll be right back. This is The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. I'm John Dankosky. You can join us at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. You can call us at 860-275-7266. We're here this week with Max Reese from NBC Connecticut, Daniela Altomare from the Hartford Current, Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief, Connecticut Mirror. Colin McEnroe is not here this week. I was joking before about why Colin isn't here. Here's why Colin isn't here. We have an open seat in the 5th Congressional District. Elizabeth Esty announced she won't be seeking re-election due to her mishandling of abuse and harassment charges against her former chief of staff. And talk about Elizabeth Esty and whether or not she's completely out of this race in just a moment. Among the people who've kind of been hinting about a possible run is our good friend Bill Curry, a regular Democratic political analyst here, of course, a former advisor to Bill Clinton. He is someone who served as a state comptroller. He was a former nominee for governor a few times. He's also a very close with Colin McEnroe. And so Colin is kind of recusing himself from that conversation about the 5th Congressional District. I don't know. I guess we'll start there, Paz. Bill Curry potentially getting back into a race for the 5th District. We've not yet heard for sure, and I've got no inside information about this, about whether he's going to jump in.
Bill Curry was among the candidates or potential candidates who attended a meet and greet session that Democrats held in Waterbury last week. And it was really kind of the coming out party for a woman named Johanna Hayes, who was the winner of the National Teacher of the Year Award. Got some significant FaceTime with Barack and Michelle Obama. She was on the Ellen DeGeneres Show. She is an example, I think, of how both parties this cycle have looked for a candidate who has a great biography and a great story, and perhaps we can get to that in a second. But Bill was there, certainly testing the waters, talking to people. There were some Bernie Sanders supporters around Bill. They were very encouraging of him. But since then, he's putting off the decision for several days. He had told me that night he was going to probably announce last Friday and then Monday, and now today's Wednesday. Bill, if you're out there, give me a call.
You're messing with our wheelhouse schedule, Bill, is really what we're trying to say. But this is the thing that's most important to me.
He's looking if is the money there, is the support there. He ran for, I won't say that seat, but it was sort of that seat back when there were 6 congressional seats. He was actually the candidate in 1982. We all remember 1982.
Yeah,
Very well.
I know
remember,
Max does.
I remember it very well. It was a great year. Dodgers won the series. It was a great year.
So Bill Curry, a name that goes back to roughly that district back in to 1982. And then Max, Johanna Hayes, as Mark had said earlier, is a very dynamic speaker, National yep. Teacher of the Year, someone who's gained a little bit of fame and certainly someone who I would think Democrats could rally around. These are two very different potential candidates.
They are. Well, then, and then, of course, there's Mary Glassman, who's very much a known entity to a lot of people, former lieutenant governor candidate for Selectman of Simsbury, who's been very active with press releases over $100,000, I think they said the other day, with fundraising. I think the big challenge for a Johanna Hayes, number one, she can go into places like Waterbury and Meriden and New Britain and do very well, especially connections to Barack and Michelle Obama. The appearance on the Ellen DeGeneres Show was actually kind of extremely entertaining. It was really a great show. You got to raise a ton of money to run for Congress. You got to raise probably north of $2 million. It's very difficult to see any of the current Republicans running do that. But I think someone like Johanna Hayes can certainly make a dent, especially if she has the backing of U.S. Senator Chris Murphy, which it sounds like she does. And look, if Mary Glassman is already there with $100,000, it's a pretty good pacing between now and Is there a nominating convention next week? And
Monday night.
Monday night. Yeah. There you go.
It's actually Monday night. And I don't know, Daniela, on one hand, you look at this and say, okay, it's an open congressional seat, and you'd think that you'd have more people wanting to fill this gap and jump in. Although it's kind of a crappy job. I mean, this is a congressional seat that has been contested over the years. Obviously, whenever there's a Democratic incumbent for some time, there's a little bit more space that Elizabeth Esty is able to create. Same thing with the second congressional district. After a couple of close elections, Joe Courtney is able to be someone who's, you know, pretty solid in his seat. Now that it's open again, you face the possibility of getting that job as a Democrat or Republican, and immediately having to start raise a whole lot of money for the next cycle coming up in 2 years. I mean, is this something worth fighting for, I guess the question.
It is one of the crappier jobs in politics. I mean, let's face it, like Max said, you've got to constantly be raising money. I mean, it's you know, you're not a U.S. senator. You've seen some of the, quote, rock star candidates, you know, Bill Pettit on the Republican side and, the Sandy Hook parents on the Democratic side say, no thanks. You know, they don't want to do it. They don't want to move to Washington. They want to travel, you know, up here all the time. I mean, it's grueling. It's tiring. That said, I think, you know, among some Democrats, Johanna Hayes is a rock star, and there seems to be a lot of excitement building around her. I mean, we have an all-white delegation right now, other than Rosa DeLauro, all male. So, you know, she would add a lot to the ticket. There does seem to be a lot of excitement about, you know, as Paz said, her biography and her background. We'll see. It will definitely be interesting. To see it unfold on Monday night.
Yeah, she had a child young. She could have easily been one of those stories of somebody who just did not make it in the United States. And, you know, by going to a community college and then going to college, she has built this incredible teaching career. I mean, she is just beloved in the Waterbury school system, and she's a good communicator. We sort of talked around race. She's black. She would be the first black Democrat elected to Congress from Connecticut. There has been one other black member of Congress from Connecticut. That was a Republican, Gary Franks, in that same district. So there's excitement there. But one of the things that Bill Curry is wrestling with is, how can a candidate of ideas, of who has been a critic of the Democratic Party, of saying the Democratic Party's kind of lost its way, it doesn't, what does it stand for, is up against somebody who is a great story. And if you look at what the Republicans tried to do, they tried to recruit Dr. Bill Pettit, who is a name because of a god-awful tragedy. He was elected to the General Assembly. He's a bright guy. He would have been a very credible candidate. But, you know, they wanted him for his name. And the Democrats did the same thing. They reached out to Mark Barden and Nicole Hockley, two Sandy Hook parents. And they said, no, they don't want to do it. So Johanna Hayes is something cut from that cloth. It's a personal story. She's really unvetted about a whole bunch of issues, you know, so they're sort of rolling the dice a little bit. But again, she's dynamic, a good communicator, and a great story.
And as we've heard from Bill Curry here for years, I mean, he has been pushing Max, the Democratic Party, to be more a party of ideas, less a party of celebrity. That has not necessarily held him in great favor with the party. He's been very critical during the Obama years for the last 8 years of his own party. I assume that if you need Democrats to rally behind you, that probably doesn't help all that much.
If you've been critical of the entity you're trying to represent for so long, it's kind of hard to do that, especially in a district that's been going further and further to the right in presidential years that the 5th Congressional District has. More Republican votes in 2016 than in 2008, which is interesting. And the other candidate, you also have Manny Sanchez. He's an alderman from New Britain. He's another one very popular in New Britain. He's viewed kind of like a rock star in New Britain, if you will. And then on the Republican side, Manny Santos, the former Meriden mayor, though it's a weak mayor system there. It's not a strong mayor system, so it makes you kind of wonder what do you do all that much when you're the mayor of Meriden, kind of thing. And then there's Ruby O'Neill, another one from Southbury. you know, the Republicans going to have to do a lot with name recognition. But if someone like Jahana Hayes is in the race, or even Mary Glassman, Manny Sanchez, those all have a leg up over someone like Bill Curry.
I will just ask you quickly, Paz, is there any chance whatsoever that Elizabeth Estes' decision to step away from this race results in her maybe deciding that she's going to get back into this race?
No,
absolutely not.
That ship has sailed.
Mm-hmm. That ship has sailed, and Danielle is shaking her head.
Absolutely. Although
she's nodding. She's not shaking her head. She's
nodding
in agreement.
And then nodding, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I was shaking to your question, no. And to Paz's answer, yes.
Yes.
Although there was that kind of weird tweet storm a couple of late that Friday night, a couple of weeks ago, where she just went on a very lengthy explanation about, you know, sort of what she plans to do in her remaining time in office. But I agree with Paz. There's no way.
Chris Murphy's lining up – well, I should say Chris Murphy's staff, people around him, are lining up votes at this nominating convention Monday. Yeah, it is Monday. And so it's not like they're stuck and she's going to walk in and everybody's going to say, oh, my God, Elizabeth,
yeah.
we want you. We yeah. need you. That's
not
going to
happen.
Okay, not going to happen. Let's move quickly before we run out of time to the governor's race. I love this article, Daniela. Prasad Srinivasan making house calls to Republican delegates. He's been he's been playing on the fact that he's a physician, an mm-hmm. allergist, and so he's actually going around trying to gin up some support for himself door to door.
Yeah, he's going to visit delegates. I mean, these delegates are getting deluged with mailers and phone calls and everything else. You know, it's crunch time. The convention the convention starts Friday. The governor will be discussed on Saturday, and so everybody's kind of pulling out all the stops, and that's his shtick. Obviously, he's tied up at the legislature, unlike some of these guys who can campaign full time. So he's, you know, just going to visit the delegates door to door, making that personal connection. I'll just put in a plug: if anyone hasn't taken our quiz at the Hartford Current on it's Tinder for Politics, which governor candidate matches your interests, you can take a quiz and. See who, you know, among the vast field of Republicans and Democrats you should support.
I don't even know what to say about that. Tinder for Politics, huh? He's shaking his head.
Up your game, Connecticut Mirror. Up your game.
I know, seriously. Yeah, yeah, well. That sounds like the sort of thing that the Connecticut Mirror could get into. I'll just ask you quickly, Max, you'd mentioned earlier, so Tony Harp getting sort of on the same side with Joe Ganim over the issue of whether or not Hartford should get a bailout. Of course, she's not on the same side as Joe Ganim when it comes to who should be the next governor of Connecticut. She's really thrown her support behind Ned Lamont, as we've seen a lot of other Democrats around the state have done.
And don't let this confuse. It's made very clear by a number of people close to Tony Harp. She has no interest in being lieutenant governor. She said that is not a job she wants. It does not appeal to her. She's told confidants. Yeah, and it looks like the Red Sea is parting and the stars are aligning among many Democrats for Ned Lamont. It's what it's looking like. But every Democrat you talk to will say Susan Bicewicz is as intense a campaigner and a politician as you'll find. And then there's Joe Ganim, who's looking to petition his way onto the ballot. Paz is far more familiar with that process, but that's a tall order as well. But it looks like a lot of Democrats are lining up behind Ned Lamont, and looks like there's going to be a lot less drama next week among Democrats, perhaps, than at the Republican convention.
What do you see in this convention, Paz? We just have about a minute or so left, but we have Susan Bicewicz not going away. We've got Joe Ganim petitioning to get on the ballot. I mean, what do you see in these three candidates here?
There is momentum to Ned Lamont. I'm not sure how much enthusiasm there is, but I think the party has looked at the field at this point and decided this is our best shot. We're going to go with him. And unlike the Republicans, we're going to try to avoid total chaos all summer.
Mm. Is it going to be total chaos all summer, really?
They could have a 6 or 7 way primary. And you do that, really anyone could be elected. So you can have some very bizarre things. You can have somebody win a major party nomination with less than 20%. And, you know, again, really funky things can happen when that small a number of voters picks a major party nominee.
I mean, Paz said 7, even 5 is a problem. Yeah. Even 5 becomes just a mess. And, you know, without a runoff provision in the state, he's exactly right.
Funky things always happening here on The Wheelhouse with Max Reese, political reporter for NBC Connecticut, Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror, Daniela Altomare, State House Reporter at the Hartford Current. Thank you all very much. You can take the quiz on the Hartford Current. I think I'm going to go do that right now. The technical producer for today's show is Gene Amatruda. Katie Talarski, our executive producer. Scott Brady produces The Wheelhouse. Lydia Brown, thanks for your help with the show today. Continue the conversation, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse.